Greetings from Podcastville. The Church of What's Happened Now is brought to you by On It. Start the new year off fucking healthy. You made resolutions like a fucking mama Luke, didn't you? Now you got to follow up on them. Start with a little Alpha Brain, a little Shroom Tech Sport. Give mama a stabbing, give you some more oxygen. A little Shroom Tech Immune. Take care of yourself. It's a whole new fucking year. As Tony Soprano said, be a good friend to yourself. Go to onit.com right now and press in.
Church.
Bam! And get 10% off. Delivered right to your crib. Now, since we're starting the new year off healthy, you also want to start the new year with a clean asshole. Let me tell you something. The fucking internal system, it starts with the fucking muffler first. Once your muffler gets all fucked up, it eats you from the inside out. And the next thing you know, you're walking around with a tube. Why? Because you didn't wipe your ass and you left that little peanut on your ass. Then the skin grows over your ass and now you got fucking problems. That shit ends today. Why? HelloTushy.com is here to rescue you. Joey, what's HelloTushy? HelloTushy is a portable bidet you put in your favorite bathroom at the house. And after you take that fucking shit of debt, you put that fucking water on, it sprinkles your ass. So, you hear Mexican music, even though you're fucking French. You might be French, and all of a sudden you start hearing Mexican music when that water hits your ass. You wipe it down with a little antiseptic, forget about it. Your muffler's clean, ready to be licked. You understand me? Go to HelloTushy.com and press in.
Muffler.
Boom! And get 10% off right now. Start the year off healthy and start the year off with a clean asshole, all right? Kick that fucking mule, Lee. What? Oh, shit. It's the 4th of January, you bad motherfuckers. We're starting out with some real fucking... These are the brothers, the BT Express, dropping it. Oh, shit. It, motherfuckers. It's 2019.
Whatever it is.
Do it. Do it till you're satisfied. Go on and do it. Do it.
What?
Do it till you're satisfied.
Whatever it is.
Do it. Do it till you're satisfied. People know just what they
are. Are you fucking kidding me or what?
Whatever
this is Bill Cosby music right here, Jack.
As long as you can.
This is how Bill Cosby gets into the trailer. He put this music on. What?
Come on and do it. Do it.
Do it while you're passed out. Oh shit.
Do it.
Oh shit. It's the Church of What's Happening Now, motherfuckers. Jimmy Two Shoes Schubert, the Christ Killer, and Uncle Joey coming at you. Happy fucking New Year, you dirty fucking savages. I love you. We made it another... Can you believe we made it another year? Did you wake up on the first going, what the fuck happened last night? I didn't do dick for years. I stay on my mind, my business. I don't want to see nobody. I want to talk to nobody. I don't want to get no fucking ear beatings. Jimmy Two Shoes Schubert's in the house.
What's up, baby? Happy New Year.
Direct from fucking Philadelphia. My man, the Christ Killer, got his dick sucked on New Year's like a doctor. Look at him. He's all ready to go.
Look, yeah, he called me and I was home alone. He's like, you got to do something.
So I told him, you're 30 years old. I give my pinky to be 30. I'd be out there mingling, getting chlamydia. That'd be on my fucking resolution list. New Year's Eve.
Don't jinx me.
Acquire chlamydia.
Yeah.
That's
get some genital. Yeah,
30 years old. He wanted to stay in and watch fucking, what were you watching?
I watched Inside Man. I like that
one. Yeah, I watched an Inside Man. I forgot how good that was in this movie. As soon as you said that to me, I almost went over there and dick smacked you. You're 30 years old. Go take a hit of coke or something. Do something. You can't stay in the fucking house when you're 30. Me, I'm 56. What the fuck do I give a fuck?
Yeah, it's those days of going out, you know, I'm over it, you know. It's like amateur night. Everybody goes out. And I was actually surprised, like, more people weren't, like, when you're out there doing the clubs, you know, it's always a good night. But I'm surprised. Most people were relatively behaved. You know, some people just, in the years past, you get hammered, just throwing up in the audience. Happy New Year. I don't know why people start the new year off like that, you know.
People really don't know. You're young. You know, people have these New Year's parties. They start at 6.
Yeah.
You don't know. You do two bumps of coke at 6:30. You're off and running. By 9 o'clock, there ain't no stopping you.
You got fish lips.
You don't even remember the fucking bell going down. You don't remember nothing. Yeah. And that's what happens to people. Listen, I'm guilty. Guilty. I think I did it one year where I got whacked. And then I didn't like getting high on New Year's. I thought it was bad luck to be high. I didn't want cocaine in my nose when the
Yeah, well, because it's a new year. You got new opportunities. You got new things. And like,
but I'd snort my ass off on the 1st.
Yeah.
Then on January 1st, during one of those bowl games, I'd be snorting, whacking off, banging one out. But it's so weird how, no, like New Year's never really, and in comedy, I think they torture the fucking consumer too much. And I don't like that. Yeah. I want a comedy club patron to have a good experience.
Absolutely.
And there was one particular year that I was working that never went out of my mind, and I felt bad for the consumer. In my world, I'm not supposed to think of the consumer, but I don't like getting ripped off. None of us as consumers like getting ripped off, so I'm not paying double for a fucking comic I could see.
Yeah.
So you could give me a shitty piece of salmon. That comedy club salmon, it's got eyeballs and shit, six eyeballs, and it's brown skinned, you know, or a steak at a comedy club. I'm not doing it. Like, yeah. That's the dumbest fucking thing in the world. That's like going to a strip club and ordering salmon. The guy's got pubic hair falling on it and fucking stripper juice, and, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me. I always think of the consumer. How would I feel? You know, years ago, I got a call from an ex-girlfriend of mine, years ago. And she said she was going to C.J. Moore, and the club she was at was the worst thing ever, that they treated her like a piece of meat.
Yeah.
And I always thought about that. You know, I've always thought about how people think. As much as I have no empathy a lot of times, people might not think I'm empathetic. I'm very empathetic. I remember working with a comic and me going up to him as a feature act and being a fan of his.
Right.
Like wanting to be that guy and going up to him and going, there's a bunch of people outside that want to talk to you, like 11 people. And he goes, fuck them. And I was like, that's a mental note, that I'm not going to have that attitude.
Absolutely.
If I ever get to that level.
I don't get it either.
There's just little things that you don't understand. I don't like shows where people have to stand. I don't like shows where I have to look at the audience and they look like they're fucking they're just having a bad experience.
Yeah.
I don't like putting audiences.
Well, because it's not really like,
oh, you can make $10,000 more. I don't care.
Yeah.
I'd rather not make the money than piss them off and have them come back a second time.
Yeah.
Then go, I went there and I had a bad experience. I know what clubs I go to, that it's a bad experience when I'm there. I can feel it.
Yeah.
Those clubs I'll never go back to. Like, I just won't go back to them.
Yeah, because it's counterproductive what you're trying to do. You're trying to put everybody in a good mood. You're trying to make them laugh. The whole purpose of your thing is to make them laugh and put them in a great mood. And it's really tough to do that if they're jammed in. There's no room to move. They're, like you said, they're being charged double or triple what they pay for a normal show. And then they throw out. I mean, some clubs do it right. Don't get me wrong. There's some clubs that do it right. They cater the food in. It's top shelf. It's, you know, and they want everybody to have a good experience, because I think a lot of clubs think that that's cool. Like, you're stepping over a dollar to pick up a penny.
A penny, yes.
For one fucking night, and those people will never come back to your establishment.
Never come back again.
Because they had a bad experience. So, like you said, it's counterproductive. But you're right. Some people do it. They like to gouge. So it's like price gouging during a natural disaster. Like, people raise their gas like $3. And it's like, fuck, it's like, why would you do that to people? They're already down. Why are you kicking them? You know, make sure you have a good customer experience. Plus, people that come to your clubs now, they have a great customer service. They'll come back again and again. You're building a brand. Every time I come here, I see great comedians. Sometimes I look them up, sometimes I don't. But every time I come to this club, I have a great experience. And that's kind of what you're up against now. I mean, comedy clubs are doing well. Comedy seems to be on a rise, and then someone goes and there's a bad experience at a club. That's when
I go to a club and I feel a bad experience, I don't go to that club again. I don't say it publicly or nothing like that. I just in my mind go, if I had a bad experience, they had a bad experience.
And like I said, you can't make a good, you can't make a good deal with a bad person. I mean, if they don't give a shit about the audience members or having a unique experience, then fine. But I mean, like you said,
it's weird.
I stand there and shake every hand on the way out, and I thank people for coming to see my show. And Larry the Cable Guy used to do that. That is essential. They want to meet you. They had a great experience. You shake their hand, and you come back next time and follow me on social media and come back. I mean, you want to. I mean, that's what it's all about now. These people that become fans of you, you want to nurture them and tell them to come out and see future shows. I mean, I don't know, but you're right that the clubs do that, and it's kind of creepy. But
it's weird how what I learned as an open micer. When I went back to Denver in '93, I learned something about business that was really weird. You know, I had a couple guys that all they did all day as comics was hustle rooms.
Right.
God bless these guys.
Yeah.
God bless these guys to always be in my heart, because in those days, the major clubs wouldn't give you stage time.
Yeah.
You know, they had an open mic once a month on a Sunday, and there was 12 people in there. But where you got better were these bar shows, where yeah. there's a Laker game on, or a Bronco game on, or a Nugget game, and you got to go in there and do comedy. That's where you learn how to become a comic. And then every 3 weeks, you go to an A room,
yeah,
and you figure out how to put your bar set into an A set now.
Yeah.
Because your bar set's a little dirty, it's a little bit more rugged. But what I remember is from all those sessions were, I could always tell the guys that were fans of comedy, and always tell, I'm talking about the bar owners.
Yeah.
I could always tell the bar owners that were in it for business, like a karaoke.
Right.
I didn't want to do business with them.
Right.
I wanted people that would say to me, hey, you know, can you get Jimmy Schubert in here? Wow, you know who Jimmy Schubert is. Yeah, my favorite's Bill Hicks. Like, those are the comedy club owners that you want to do comedy with.
Yeah, because they care about the art form.
And then 2 weeks go in and they'll go, come here for a second. Can you get me Fluffy? And now you got to bring them down to earth and go, Fluffy's 20 G's.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But
is there another fat Mexican out there that we could say, you know, they are a fan of comedy.
Yeah.
If they're losing money,
yeah,
they continue the show.
And I always love working for guys like that.
Yes.
And I always love working
guys
in open comedy clubs that are still like that. You love working for guys like that, you know, because they understand that. You know, the art form, they're fans of it. How could you get mad at a guy who, you know, creates an environment for you to make a living doing something you love to do, that's a fan of the comedy and the art form? I love working for those guys. That's like, you know, one of those.
There's a lot of guys you work for that, number one, they have, when you get to that club, they show up on Thursday. Listen, if you think after 20 years I'm going to watch a comic 5 nights in a row if I'm the club owner, you got rocks in your head. Okay? I don't even want to see a fucking comic again. I've been here for 16 years working every fucking night, banging it out with comics. I got a kid in high school. You know, this is the essential comedy club owner,
right,
who you talk to now. When I go to a club, you know, like you get a survey from the airlines now. Were you satisfied? When I go to a club, the first thing I look for is Thursday night.
Right.
I want the owner to show up.
Right.
If I fucking worked on Twitter and social network and gave this podcast to sell this place out,
yeah,
I expect to see you there, shake my hand. I don't give a fuck if you show up the rest of the weekend. I'd rather not have you around with your tight ass, because I'm going to be sparking in here. You know, I'm going to be doing what I do. I don't want you around, but I like those guys. I like those guys that call you Friday and go, if you need something, call the club manager and he'll drive you to whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't need anything. I'll Uber.
Yeah.
But I like those guys. That goes into the package. For me, it's not the money. I'd rather make less money and get treated like a human being, and for them to understand. You know, when I go into a comedy club and half the staff says to me, I heard the podcast with Jimmy Schubert, that means the world to me.
Yeah.
You know, me and Lee used to do a podcast at a club where every week the lady would call me. She didn't know what a podcast was. And I said to Lee, we're never coming down here again, because I can't deal with somebody who in the height of podcast doesn't know what a podcast is and managing a comedy club.
Yeah.
I'd rather not make that money. I'd rather avoid that whole fucking situation. Because if you're a fan of comedy and you're a comedy club manager, how don't you know about the podcast world?
Yeah. Dude, it is the single thing that has made comedy clubs come back again. Is the podcasting. You would go to a comedy store, you got 3 shows that are sold out. It's because of the podcasting. It's people talk about that place. It's why it's sold out every night. I mean, how are you, like you said, how could you go to be business and not know what a fucking podcast is?
I can't.
I mean, what the fuck? It's like somebody's looking at the, you know, your comedy special, you're trying to sell it. He goes, yeah, I watched a couple minutes of it. I said, did you not watch the whole fucking thing? And just a couple, you watched 5 minutes of it? Is that enough? But it's like, it's weird. It's the same thing. It's like, you know, take a minute. How busy are people?
Well, here's the thing. The comedy podcast brought comedy back because people got to meet who we are now.
Yeah.
People get to see the real you. You know, for years I thought, like I said, I was a fan of that guy's. And I saw him do HBO specials, and I saw him do Young Comedian specials. And then I worked with him, and I never fucking paid attention to him again. And now people avoid all that. You know what's in my heart. You know what's in my head. You know what my opinions are on certain fucking things.
Yeah.
You know, they know. People don't come to a show. Very rarely anymore do I see somebody get up in the middle of my set and walk out. 10 years ago, people would walk out by the dozens.
Really? Yeah.
Oh.
Well, no, now you found. You found your fan
base. When I did
you
the longest yard, people would walk out by the handfuls. By the handfuls.
Now they know what they're getting. They know what they're seeing. They know who they're coming to see. You know?
I still remember one particular weekend in Atlanta. Before Laughing Skull, he had a big club. Do you remember Laughing Skull?
Yeah, it was like an amusement thing. The guy was able to pay the comedians with the coins he made off all the amusement games.
Yes,
because that place was packed with the comedy club, and it was like he didn't care if the audience was.
It was fucking crazy.
Yeah.
I remember going in there right after the longest yard on the way in. Fucking people were touching me, taking, like, in those days, people didn't really bother you for pictures, but people were like doing different shit. Like, we can't wait to see it. And I still remember getting off that stage and those same people looking away.
Yeah.
Like, I still remember going to all those rooms and just walking people by the handful.
Yeah. Well, you know, I tell you the truth, Kinison used to do the same thing. I would remember I was a doorman at the Comedy Store before he got his fucking, before he was, you know, he would fucking, we would walk people out of the main room. He goes, I want you to take the names of three people who died that were close to you. Just write down the names of the three singers and then put it on a napkin and just hand them up here so I can wipe my ass with it. And people would make a fucking beeline for the door like they never, like, but you know, but that's what happens until you find your fucking groove, you know what I mean? I mean, people, like, you know, now the people are coming to see you, want to come see you. They know what you're doing, you know what I mean? But it's so funny, like, people go, like, how people come to a comedy club and don't, like, Google somebody and see what they do, and they get upset in the showroom going, I didn't know, didn't you fucking Google?
No, but I seen three famous walks.
Yeah.
The best walk I ever seen was, one of the best walking a room was James Inman out of Seattle, Washington.
Yeah.
You know James Inman? He's been around for a long time.
Yeah, I've heard that name.
Crazy, crazy motherfucker.
Would walk a whole room.
He would walk half of it. Him and Kathy Sorbo, a blonde little cute thing from Seattle.
And they just walk a room.
I remember them walking Bremerton one night, like walking dirty people.
Wow.
And then, but the walk, the best walk out ever was Stanhope, 98, Seattle, Washington. They were walking out in packs of threes, and he would yell at them and go, hold on, before you leave, I want you to hear this tit-fut joke. Or he would say something to him, why are you leaving? Come on, you know you're going to go home and fuck her up the ass and put your dick in the face. I mean, he was insulting them as they were leaving.
Yeah.
That was fucking classic. Like, they were walking out in threes.
Yeah, and just I love that, though. But the not giving a
not
fuck.
Not to give a fuck. That's a complete different gift.
No, that is. I mean, dude, I watched fucking Bill Burr. I was at the show in Philly when Bill Burr got fucking booed. I was getting booed by like 10,000 people and just fucking going at him. Like, fucking just, like, the sheer information he had about the city of Philadelphia and their sports teams and their losses and just fucking just jamming it down their throat. It was fucking brilliant. Like, just people were, half the people were loving it, half the people were, boo! But it was fucking great. I'll never forget. I was watching, I was looking at Dom, and Dom goes, he's got 11 minutes left. And just after that, Bill Burr went, I got 11 minutes left, and I'm doing all of it. And I was just fucking dying. What balls to fucking, but it's fucking fucking great, dude. I love that.
What are the options? You can't walk off the stage because you lose.
Yeah.
It's a psychological loss. You just lost. It's you and a microphone against 300 people.
Yeah, dude, I was the first guy out there. They started fucking booing me about I'm sitting there taking fucking haymakers.
Taking haymakers?
A couple minutes till I fucking realized. I go, these motherfuckers are booing. I didn't realize they were fucking booing at first. And then they're fucking booing and 10,000 people and your fucking family in the audience. And I know those fans. If I go fucking off on these motherfuckers, I was only supposed to do like 8 minutes anyway. And so I said, hey, thank you. You guys have been great. But the minute I fucking, next thing you know, they're throwing fucking bottles at my head. That's Philadelphia, bro. They threw batteries at fucking, you know, they throw batteries at people. They boo Santa Claus. They're horrible fucking people.
Listen.
I just want to, I just said, thank you. You've been great.
Listen, bro.
And got the fuck out of there.
I love Philadelphia.
Yeah, I do too.
I mean, with my heart. I belong in Philadelphia. The
That's
way
a great
I belong
city.
In Sinaloa, Mexico.
Yeah.
My thinking is of Philadelphia. I think of, when I think of Philadelphia, I think of getting off the plane and seeing Joe Frazier's gym and my dick getting hard.
Yeah.
And that mentality, that Joe Frazier mentality, that's the mentality of the city.
Yeah.
I remember their football teams. I remember going there to see the Stones.
Yeah.
I remember going there to see Black Sabbath, Dio. You know, I spent a lot of time at Glassboro College. I spent a lot of time at those stupid cheese shop places, which I have no fucking idea what their names were then or whatever.
Oh, Patch and Gino's, a cheesesteak.
Yeah, this is 80, this is 80, 81, yeah. 82, 83. I was in Philadelphia 10 times a fucking year. Then when Dr. J went to Philly, forget about it.
Yeah.
I learned Philadelphia. I would go to those games at the Spectrum and save the coupons, because if they scored over 125 points, you got a free hamburger at the corner joint, and then there'd be 1,000 fucking bourguignons and Chinese people. You gotta wait up to get a free cheeseburger. You know what happens when you give away a free cheeseburger in Philadelphia? You know what that's like? That's like bat day at Yankee Stadium when the Red Sox are coming. You're just inciting a war. You know what I'm saying? You're just inciting a fucking war. But what is well known about Philadelphia that I don't have to tell a guy like you is, in the 70s, they already had a jail. At RFK Stadium, or JFK Stadium.
As a courtroom and a jail.
A courtroom and a jail. This is just to let you know, people. In the 70s, if you look at all the biggest world tours of rock musicians, the first night was always Philadelphia. Why? To get it out of the way. To get it out of the way. We're going to get tortured.
I know.
Let me tell you how back I go with Philadelphia, just to tell you motherfuckers. I go back to Philly. July 81, look it up and Google me back or whatever if I'm right or I'm wrong, the date here. It had to be July of 81, 80, Black Sabbath with Ronnie James Dio, Sammy Hagar before Van Halen, and somebody else. Philadelphia, I had never seen this before. My fucking whole life at the age of 17, 18, they were spitting on their fingers. They would clam on their fingers and flick the finger spit at you. I was in sixth row at Black Sabbath, and the first five rows were just people spitting on their fingers and flinging it at Sammy Hagar. Sammy Hagar's on stage fucking evading spit. Okay, so I put all these things together in my head that you can't sing in Philly. The football. Didn't they hit somebody with a battery at a football game?
Yeah, they threw, there was one of the Dallas Cowboys. They thought he hurt his neck. I think it was maybe Drew Pearson at number 88.
They don't give a fuck.
And he fucking, it was like a fucking, and they started throwing fucking batteries at the guy as they're carting them off. Like, they booed fucking Santa Claus. Now, granted, that was like December 15th. Santa Claus is only Santa Claus one day a year. That's December 25th. So that guy was just a fat guy in a red suit rooting for the wrong team. They fucking booed him out of, but I mean, they're notoriously fucking horrible. Why else would you put a jail? Like, they're consistently number two worst fans in every sport.
But nobody, it's a great, it's what Dice taped this special.
Yeah.
Which, if you want,
if they love you, bro, they love you.
If they love you, they love you.
They love
and that's
you.
Why I love going there every year. Yeah. I go there every year.
Yeah. Was it the Heaven and Hell tour?
Yeah.
August 9th of 1980.
Yeah.
August 9th.
They spit at him. When Ronnie James Dio took the stage, they were booing him.
Yeah, they were throwing horrible things, bro.
Drinks.
Yeah, they fucking.
And security can't even control you. We did a, that's where the my buddy. In fact, we got to the show with like shitty tickets. That was like a whole fucking day. We got to the show with shitty tickets. My buddy left and came back with better tickets. He finagled 18th row for sixth row center, and then he came back with these Quaaludes that weren't really Quaaludes. They were. These long purple things. I go, Doug, what's wrong with you? You know, it was acid. He came back with these thick acid. I go, it looked like a little marshmallow that somebody spray painted purple. I go, that's not acid. He kept saying, I'm telling you, it's acid. He ate two of them, and during the show, he passed out. So on the drive home, we kept telling him, those are purple Quaaludes, and he was pissed. I'm telling you, those weren't Quaaludes.
That's
hilarious. They were acid. Then why the fuck did you pass out?
Yeah, dude.
So for years, every time he'd come to me and go, Schubert's got the best Coke or something, he'd go, oh, you know, he's got good Coke, Lee. I go, weren't you the guy that did the Purple Quaaludes in Philadelphia? He never lived. Fuck you! It was, I'm telling you, that was the best ass that I ever did.
Did I remember that? So we're going to school downtown, and they'd shave pencil shavings, and they'd sell the dudes for, like, you know, and it's real good weed, man. It's like Mexican rum, but it was pencil shavings. And these fucking stupid kids would buy it because they never knew what fucking pot looked like. And I go, you got ripped off again, you idiot.
Look, I remember being in Philly and snorting coke. We had the trunk open for that Black Sabbath tour.
Right.
The trunk, in those days, you put coolers in your trunk.
Yeah.
And you went to a concert and you tailgated.
Right.
The same way. We had the trunk open.
Yeah.
We had the two coolers out.
Getting your pre-show buzz on.
We had the car stereo on, Heaven and Hell.
Right.
We're hanging out. We had a little bottle. The plan was to go to Philadelphia and then drive to Seaside Heights and spend the night on the way back.
Right.
That was the plan. So I'd have one of those little brown bottles filled with coke to the fucking brim. And the next thing you know, a car pulls up and it's the FBI. And they throw us up against the car and they go through our shit. And that bottle was in there, dog. It was in plain sight. They were looking for bootleg t-shirts. Because people were selling bootleg t-shirts back there, and that's what they were looking for. The FBI or some shit. Fucking bootleg
t-shirts. They missed the little brown bottle.
They didn't touch that little fucking bindle of death. It was the days... When they had the little bottle with the spoon at the top.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You get it all. One man, bro. It was a guy with the bass drum and a cymbal on things.
It was a one-man band. Then they sold the kits. Remember they sold... Started opening up the kits.
Yeah.
And the kit was like a wallet, Lee. It came like a wallet.
Yeah, it was like that little... It had that little... little green. It was like an off-color green thing.
Off-color green.
Where you flip it up.
A little
slate.
A little scale. Then there was a green thing, right. And there was a scale that was tiny, that was accurate as fuck.
Yeah, bro.
Those things were little scale. I come to you.
Was it three grams?
It weighed 8 balls.
It had a fucking little alligator clip on the end of it. You put on the thing, and you'd hold it off your thumb, and it would weigh down. Like, it was just so...
That was the weed one. That was the weed one. That was the weed one. There was a weed one that you put on your thumb.
And it hugged down.
And it hugged down. And it would be perfect. And you put the bud in it, and it would weigh perfect.
Yeah.
And then they came up with the green one, the one that was compacted. You put it in your pocket, and you took it out, and you could weigh coke in it and put it at whatever. Yeah. It was good for 8 balls, grams.
Yeah, they had a digital readout one, grams. Too. That was also pretty good.
No, I never got to the digital readout. That was and then we robbed the high school. And we robbed the science lab, and we took all the triple beam scales. That was like a big shot. A teacher had to come to my house. Listen, you got to give a couple of them back. Like, they cut a deal with us. Like, you keep 30. But you got to give us 30 back. You can't leave us without triple beans. We were walking out of there every day with a triple bean scale.
Oh, that's hilarious.
One day I go, why am I walking out? We went to the high school. We took all the triple beam scales. 2 days later, Camel Breath, George McGrath, one of the fucking crazy teachers, like, listen, they know. Just give us half the scales back. I had a show, but everybody had those triple beam scales in the fucking town.
No.
Everybody had a scale at the house, Lee. How crazy is that? In the 80s, if you didn't have a scale, you were like an outcast. Like, if I went to your house, let me get a scale. Okay, it's in the back room.
Dude, there's this famous story that was like, it was one time we were at the, back in Crest Hill days, and there was this guy named Magic, this Middle Eastern dude who used to be like, you know, was the guy would be able to get Sam's stuff. You know, he's kind of like a dealer. His name is Matt. But I watched this guy one time. He took a drive.
Now, what year is this?
This is like, shit, 89.
Now, he was Arab?
Remember,
that's when there wasn't a lot of Arabs around.
No.
So if one Arab showed up, he had to be really cool. He had to show up with diamonds and coke.
Yeah. No, but he was one of those guys.
He was Sam the Arab.
And did he
and
watch
I had
this
Joe
guy?
The Arab in New York. I was telling you.
So basically.
It was cool to be Arab in the 80s.
So this dude. This dude has a bag, but he takes his two fingers, digs them into the bag. He, like, tore a page out of it. The first time I've ever seen this done, I go, this has got to be a scene in a movie. He tears a page out of the magazine, like, almost straight, folds it into, like, the perfect triangle, makes a bindle out of it. Then he looks in the freaking bag, and he fucking eyeballs. He takes his two fingers in. He grabs a bit. He fucking looks out of the eye. He throws it in the freaking bindle. You know, but a little more. Like, he just eyed an eight ball. Then, like, there was stuff on the end of his fingers. He just, like... And he just folded it up and he goes, here, take that over to Sinclair. It was like, he eyed an eight ball. I've never seen anybody do that before. In the front seat of a car, like go from like, you know, right out of the bag, into the bindle, into the thing.
If I knew what was in the bag, I could eye an eight ball.
Yeah.
And it could be off 2.5 maybe.
Yeah.
If I knew I had 7 in the bag, I could eye an eight ball.
Yeah.
If I knew I had 14, I could eye an eight ball. You know, I could eye it.
You could pretty much eye it, yeah.
I could eye it, take some out, throw it.
I was just a young kid. I was like, you know, I probably like maybe 26 or 27. And I saw that guy do that. And you go, damn, man, that's amazing.
How long have you been doing comedy for now?
Jesus, bro. I started in Philly. It was like coming up on 30 years. Yeah, but
did you know Dom back in Philly, or was Dom
no? I didn't know Dom back in Philly. There's a couple. I knew Keith Robinson back in Philly, and knew Todd Glass back in Philly, and like, you know, those were the kind of guys that we kind of started with, you know, some and yeah. But I did comedy for about like 2 years in Philly. I was going to go to New York, and I said, well, if I go to New York, eventually I'm going to have to go to L.A. anyway. And I go, I got this, you know, because I've been performing like, you know, basically like my whole life. I was doing fucking magic when I was 11 and 12. I got like 3 or 4 shows.
Don't bring it up.
Right? So I won't. So then, and then I went to, when I hit 18, I just went to clubs for a couple of years and headed out this way. Because I knew I was going to, if I went to New York, I was going to have to go to L.A. anyway. So I just said, let me just skip out the middleman and just go to L.A. And then I started working at I showcased for Mitzi like 2 weeks later. I didn't pass, but I got a job at the doorman the night that Tony Clifton was supposed to appear in the main room. It was like a year after Andy Kaufman's death. And I mean, Tony Clifton is appearing at the main room in the Comedy Store. And everybody thought, oh, fuck, it was a character that Andy Kaufman used to do. This Tony Clifton guy. They thought Andy Kaufman was a year after his death. They thought it was going to be. And that was the day I started working as a doorman. They needed extra people because it was crazy. And it was really Bob Zmuda dressed as Tony Clifton but all the media thought it was Andy Kaufman playing a joke on him. And he went up there and just fucking, I never seen anything like it. The guy was on stage like probably 15, 20 people started walking people. He's flitting like cigarettes at people, throwing drinks at people. This character, Tony Clifton, was a fucking nutbag. Empties the fucking room out, and then people were walking out like, well, we fell. Like, you know, it was just hilarious. But ever since then, I started working at the door, and then eventually I got passed as a like non-paid regular. I could do the belly room. So probably like, you know, 86, 87, you know, was where I started.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
That was big when Bob Zmuda. I never got all that, by the way.
No, I never did either. Just I mean, it was because Andy Kaufman used to do this character. And then when he would do it, like about halfway through doing the character, Andy Kaufman would do it, he gave the character to Bob Zmuda and said, you do Tony Clifton from now on. Here's the thing, because they were dressed up. It was a big deal. And everybody knew that Andy Kaufman was doing that character. They didn't realize he had handed it off for him to do. So a year after his death, when Tony Clifton's making an appearance at the main room at the Comedy Store, everybody thought this is where Andy's gonna tell everybody he didn't really die. They thought he was like playing a joke on him. So, but it was fucking crazy and it was insane. And that's like, you know, that's the night they met Bob Zmuda, who to this day continues to do the Tony Clifton character, which is
where?
Well, he does it around town. I've seen him at Flappers. I've seen him do it in Chicago at one of the Chicago comedy festivals. I mean, that's not like a big thing because most people don't remember Andy Kaufman used to do the character. It's way beyond like you should have dropped that like years ago, but he still does it. I mean, it's the stupidest thing. Like, you know, it's just like at one point it was good. He would actually try to do a show, but he's been in the Comedy Store in the main room. He does Tony Clifton. He has the singing girls. Not recently, but you know, probably like maybe two years ago, 3 years ago, he was doing it. I mean, you know, people get the backstory and they think it's kind of fun, but most people don't even know who fucking Sam Kinison was, let alone who, and even though Andy Kaufman left a big enough body work, most people don't, you know, the younger generation, they don't have any fucking reference. They don't like know, you know, you got to turn people on to Sam Kinison. They go back and look at his YouTube stuff and go, wow, that guy was fucking great. They don't know him now. He's been dead for 26 years.
The other night, I got in the Sam Kinison foxhole.
Oh, yeah.
I went to look up something on Young Comedian Special.
Oh, yeah.
And I watched Sam's set, and then there was something from, I watched something else, like a longer one, yeah. Live from Hell or something.
Yeah.
And I was fucking howling. Yeah. You know, let me tell you what happened. About an hour later, I turned off the thing, went, I think, got like a soda or something. Must have been 11:30 at night.
Right.
And I went back on social media, and I checked my Twitter. And the first tweet that came up was, hey, how fucked up was Kinison at that taping in Vegas? And I fucking go, how creepy is this shit? Some guy out of random on Twitter.
Wow.
New Year's Eve said that to me. I went down to Foxhole New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
I was in the mood for Kinison. Dude. New Year's Eve.
You don't even know how crazy that was. I mean, he had scheduled 3 fucking shows. Dude, he was like, when we did the Universal Amphitheater in frickin' that show, and he had like Ginger Baker on the drums. He had CC DeVille from Poison. Fucking David Lee Roth was there. I mean, it was like a fucking New Year's. And then we all go to the Van Nuys Airport, jump on fucking Learjets, fly to Vegas for like a 3 a.m. show. I mean, that was one of the years he did it, but Kinison also did, like, he was
a 3 a.m. show.
Do a 3 a.m. show in Vegas, bro. And but that's the one where Sam was so fucked up. His brother Bill's doing a countdown from behind the curtain. Dan! Because his brother Bill, because Sam was so fucked up, they didn't even want to do the show. But they, you know, they got him on fucking oxygen. They got him breathing. I mean, this is after staying up for like 3-4 days in a fucking row. And like your fucking room service bill is $7,500 for 3 days just in booze and shit. I mean, dude, believe me, bro, that was like, I mean, that was it, bro. I did that one trip in Vegas. I came back and I started going to fucking AA meetings. I said, I'm done. I'm fucking done, bro. I mean, I had to get a CAT scan. I thought I had brain damage.
Would that go today in comedy? No. Would that behavior fly today?
No, it doesn't. It can't go. I'm glad it happened when it did, bro, because, Joe, you know how fucking, look how hard you fucking work. You can't do that shit. You lose fucking 3 or 4 days. It's not.
I told Lee that if I was still doing coke, Lee would have been here waiting for me 10 times.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even that.
I would have been calling you going, Lee, I'll be there in 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's just plus off, dude. Yeah. We're just
that 6 a.m. podcast we used to do.
Yeah,
there's dude, no way it would have lasted 90 days.
It's insane, dude. I think about it sometimes. I get physically ill when I think about the amount of drugs. It's just the fucking people hanging out, all these fucking, like, it was just kind of like creepy, you know. I mean, fucking Kinison was my buddy, man. I got put fucking great moments in my life. I get to do the Spectrum in Philadelphia. I opened for him in front of 6,300 people. I mean, this guy was fucking. I just felt fucking bad for the dude, man. You say, you know, like, you go, the comedians today are prepared for success. It's like nobody wants to be that guy. It wouldn't fucking play. I mean, look at, you know, and God rest their souls, but the Chris Farleys and the guys that you, the John Belushis and Kinisons, it's like these.
Mitch Hedbergs.
What's that?
The Mitch Hedbergs.
Yeah, I mean, guys that you fucking were. I mean,
it just kills the.
It's not enough to be fucking a great fucking comedian. You really have to be prepared for success when it comes. And just some of us are, you know, it's just taking some of us, you know, a little longer than others. I mean, I had to learn how to become a professional. You have to learn how to do these things. And sometimes it's just, you know, I mean, I always think back on freaking kids, like, what would he have done? And I do the exact opposite. It usually works out.
My big,
you know,
fear was,
I'm gonna go.
My big fear was not getting high. Because I wouldn't be funny. Like, for the last 3 years of my cocaine life, I was at struggle with myself.
Yeah.
Because it's like being that fat guy. You get a bunch of work, but your doctor tells you need to lose weight.
Yeah.
And you lose 100 pounds and you start getting rolls.
Yeah.
You're not that fat guy no more.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing. I was really concerned about if I stop this cocaine thing.
Yeah.
That the funny will not be there anymore. That's part of the whole craziness. I thought that was really ingrained in what fueled me.
Yeah.
So the fear, that fear was what kept me from stopping. From maybe 2004 on, I wanted to quit cocaine.
Well, yeah.
But I'm like, I can't do this.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, you're such an authentic human being. I mean, some guys... you know, like us, I mean, you sometimes there's two versions. You either fucking drink and do the cocaine to fuel the fire, or you fucking try to put the fire out with using drugs and cocaine. And sometimes, you know, some guys, I feel the same way. I just had to come off it. I just didn't enjoy who I was on it anymore. And I think I wore out of gear because, you know, you do that stuff. I just couldn't do it now. I just think of is like all the fucking time.
What do you do after a show? What is your ritual after Thursday night, Friday night, and Saturday night show?
Well, usually I got to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. So I sit there. I really try to have a really great show on Thursday night. And then you get up at 6 and go do media. So I go right home. I drink a bunch of water and get up and do my media and just plan and know like what I did on those shows before. So try to do some new bits.
How about Friday night when you get back from the hotel?
Friday night, I just relax.
Do you smoke reefer? Do you do a Xanax? Do you do a pot cookie?
Yeah, I do. I would do a pot cookie that would because it kind of helps me sleep. That's why I really do it. And then just get ready for the set. For me, it's all about working on the material. Now, the high for me is doing great you know, come up with some new bits. And that gets me excited more than anything, is come up with a new bit that kills. I mean, I got a new 20 minutes in the front of my act that I just kind of got working. I mean, the first bit you come out gets a round of applause, and the second bit and the third. And I'm excited about that.
Do you feel about that today? Like, we had this fucking stupid excuse. It was a fucking excuse that, when a comic or performer gets off stage, their adrenaline, they have to keep the high going. It was this fucking bullshit that I bought into also. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah.
But I'm going to debunk that bullshit right now.
Yeah.
First off, yes, you need that needs something to take that edge off. When I come off stage and I have a great set, I'm ready to fight somebody. Yeah. Like, I want to stab somebody in the fucking lung.
Yeah.
And then you talk to your peers behind stage a little bit, and then you go out and take pictures or whatever, and then you go back to your room, and your mind starts racing. You know, for me, my mind starts racing. That's why I bring the vapor with me.
Yeah.
I roll the extra joint when I get back to the hotel.
Yeah.
You know, because that's my night to be loose. Yeah. I love my Friday night in comedy. Yeah. My Friday night in comedy, I don't have to get up.
Yeah, the next day, right?
Saturday.
Yeah, you know.
I don't have to do shit.
Yeah.
All I know is I got to beat that hotel breakfast by 11.
That's right.
Okay. If I can make it down there by 11,
you get that free
that's
breakfast.
All I need. Because even if I go to bed at 4, I'll be walking around at 9.
Yeah.
I get up at 9, I drink a cup of coffee in my room.
Yeah.
I hit the vapor pen to get the appetite going.
And then I roll a joint.
Yeah. I roll a joint. Sometimes I wash my pussy. Sometimes I go down with a dirty pussy. I just wash my hair and put some monkey juice on it. And I look Tim Top Magoo. I put Visine in my eyes. I eat that breakfast downstairs, the two eggs, the two slices of bacon, one piece of wheat toast, a cup of oatmeal. I go around for a walk around the neighborhood. I blast that fucking number. And then I go back upstairs and I put on something on Narcos.
Yeah.
Until I feel a little tired. I take that nap till 2 and I'm good.
Yeah.
So that whole debunk of we need to keep the party alive after the fucking...
No.
That's just an excuse
it's bullshit. Actually,
a junkie. I lived off it, so I could tell you.
Yeah, when I go back into the green room, I take a couple of fucking deep breaths and I let it fucking go. I mean, that's the biggest thing I do is let go of that fucking energy from the show, because it was a fucking show. Just kind of fucking calm down, go out there, get a nice fucking big bottle of water, or maybe I'll have a drink, one drink, and then get the fuck out of there. Say hi, take pictures, and then get the fuck out. I mean, I'm not about keeping the party going. I gotta do stuff. I think if I, like, you know, have those nights where you like fucking knock back like 4 or 5 drinks, you lose the next 2 days. You know, you sleep in a little bit. I guess I can't afford to do it anymore, you know?
Well,
and like you said, it's not taking care of yourself.
Well, the recovery time, listen, I couldn't handle hangovers when I was 35.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I was already puking blood. I would go to that fucking Miami Wet Willies, and I'd drink those red drinks.
Those the call a cab?
Call a cab. And I'd be fucked up.
Oh, you know who I saw Tuesday? Dave and Elliot Merrill's.
How are they doing?
Oh, dude, the Merrill's boys are great. They
you know, I was in West Palm, and I thought about them the whole time.
Oh, man, they're such good guys. Dude, I was just down there hanging with them. We had lunch. They're good. They
were Paradise Point Hotel.
Paradise Point Hotel, bro. Those guys were. Those two guys are great, man. They're from the old school, but they're
20 years, and they still haven't made that movie.
And
and they've spent millions. They got millions. Those two cocksuckers. They both walk around squeaking. Those Jew brothers. They fucking both of them. One plays tennis all day. The other one quit smoking pot.
Yeah.
So now he don't smoke pot.
No.
He was a fucking big pothead. I mean, the moment you went to Paradise Point was a hotel in South Beach.
Yeah, but they still have it. They're real. They're very low key, but they, like you said, they live like doctors in
They live like doctors in West Palm. I think the father had, they invented the tennis racket.
Yeah.
He's got more money than fucking, And they were just these two sweet brothers. They were tremendous. I mean.
Yeah. Hey, you know, there was a time where, like, you know, you got hung out with those guys that took care of you.
God. You went to. Yeah. I would stay in Miami. They'd give me a room at the hotel for free. That you could walk to a bodega where they were at. There's a movie called Empire, one of the worst movies you'll ever see.
Yeah.
It's got John Leguizamo and a couple other people in the movie. Madonna's husband's in it.
Yeah.
It's an interesting movie if it's late night and you're by yourself and it's on HBO. But the scene where he goes to Miami to shoot the guy. And he meets a guy, and he tells him, the guy tells him to spit the gum out of his mouth, and he goes, why? He goes, put the gun under the piece of the table. The gun's waiting for you. It's like me calling you and going to Philly. I need a piece when I get there. And all of a sudden, you go, meet me at this bodega. That bodega was walking distance from Paradise Point, and they sold Cuban food by the pound. Lee, you have no idea. I would get fucked up till 6, 7 in the morning, get up at 10, and walk over to that fucking bodega, a bodega that had tremendous Cuban food. And they would get one of those fucking containers, like you get at Chowling's, what's that fucking Chinese restaurant? When you get the 5 different orders,
yeah,
they would put black beans on one, rice pack it in.
Oh, yeah, I remember that joint. It was fucking great.
Oh, with a side order of fried bananas and 2 or 3 cans of Coca-Cola, and I'd walk back to that hotel, and I'd inhale that food, smoke a joint, and go right back to bed. Every room that has a different theme.
Yeah.
They're like the pirates' room. They got like the fucking...
There was one was the sea, where it was all the sea creatures.
Right,
and stuff.
The sea creatures.
But all the rooms had their own theme, but they had like 8 rooms down there. And dude, during...
And they had a rooftop patio.
And during the season, all the models that were down there would stay there. So they all these beautiful girls, these skinny, hot, sexy European models would come down there. And then every afternoon would be a roof in the party, and then they'd play guitar.
Yeah,
they'd go up the roof party, and Montrez would sing his, you know, play his music.
And Montrez is one of those black singers that would make white girls' pussies go crazy.
Yeah, you could wring out the panties.
Oh my God, Montrez was fucking brilliant.
He's great. He's still,
you know,
yeah.
He still lives in the basement, I think.
Yeah,
they still got him living in the office. Montrez is one of those guys that fell between the cracks, and it happens in comedy.
Yeah,
and it happens in music, and it happens all the time because just something didn't click.
Well, it's like anything else. I mean, you know, it's like, yeah, you're right. It happens. You see all that stuff. You see it with music. You see it with bands. It's fucking, you know, Tommy Conwell and the Young Rumblers has been.
He can fucking sing, man.
Oh, yeah, he can sing. He still can sing.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I did a thing about my first 10 years of comedy. I came on the podcast and wrote it out. I really thought about it because I just wanted people to know what you need to go through. You know, I went through the first 3 years where I would just tell people I was a comic, and I'd get on stage once every 2 weeks, and I would improvise and not have any material, and then I finally fell in love with it, and I attacked it, and then and then I moved to LA, and I felt bad afterward because I re-looked it over, and I didn't mention you one time. And this is why I'm having you on the podcast today, to apologize to you. Because there's nobody who helped me out when I got here more than you.
Oh, really?
Like, yeah. Like, I remember talking to a certain comic up at the store one night. And I don't know how you and me connected. And you said, don't talk to him. He's a fucking loser. And then at that time, you had just gotten your first deal when you came back from Montreal. And the guy from NBC came up to you.
Yeah.
I mean, you hooked me up with your manager, who I just spoke to the other day.
Jeff Kittler, who I love.
Who I love dearly. Yeah. You taught me the ropes. You even gave me a briefcase to take my notes and notebooks on the road with me that I just recently threw away when I moved to the Valley because it was such a beat up suitcase.
Yeah, it was already broken.
But it had so much tradition.
Yeah.
Like you had put 10 years into it.
Oh, yeah.
It was like a suitcase to have your headshots and resumes.
Yeah, well, just because you want to take
it
serious.
Notebooks.
Because you're coming out here, you know, people don't get it. It's like, it's really like, kind of like when you're out on the road and you're traveling, you're touring, it's like playing college ball. But when you get to L.A., and even though it's a fucking, it's really kind of running with the pros because you're gonna have auditions and you're going to have shit. And you go, this isn't a fucking game anymore. And you're competing some of the best people. In the, you just got to have your fucking shit together a little bit.
No, you schooled me, and I want to thank you. I wanted to take the time.
Dude, it's my pleasure.
I remember you were taking acting classes on Mondays at the Improv. With that dude who was like a high level acting coach.
Yeah, he was. He worked with comedians specifically. I want to say Krakauer.
Yes, Bob Krakauer.
Bob Krakauer.
You got me. I couldn't afford.
And that guy, you know, was in that acting class.
Who?
It was Jeff Jenna. It was Jimmy Fallon. It was me. It was Kathleen Madigan. It was like, you know, there were some, Todd Glass was, I mean, some heavyweight, like, fucking comics at the time. And he specifically worked with comedians and trying to, dude, I booked everything with that
with
fucking
that
guy.
Yeah.
I love Bob Krakauer because he got what you did. He goes, and I would work, like, if I had an audition, I could work with him in class and then go do it later on. amazing. Him and a woman named Karen West. I mean, you know, look, I got little parts here. I got bigger parts here. I got some. But, you know, people don't realize that collectively you get that fucking money from Shaw and you get residuals and you get your insurance and you get the fucking bank and a credit union. You get benefits from the fucking union that you didn't get with fucking stand up. And so I was always like, yeah, I got to keep my fucking feet because it's just.
Well, it's funny that I learned that from you.
Yeah.
By the time our paths crossed, I had already realized that I was not going to get any love as a stand-up. The stand-up cards were not at that time. Montreal didn't want me. Improvs didn't want me. I couldn't find a manager.
Yeah, dude.
I couldn't find an agent. I mean, it just, and you had books, you had booked Go.
Yeah.
You had just booked Go.
And I just.
What year did Go come on? 97?
It came out in 99.
I was hanging with you before that.
We were hanging.
I was hanging with you before that.
But I booked that fucking role. I mean, I just got back from my 12-year-old cousin, Joey Casey, had passed away, and I wasn't in the fucking mood for the Hollywood bullshit. And I went in, and I had a couple auditions that day, and they called me back for it. And I just fucking threw it, and I just fucking did my thing. And I really threw the chair down. I kicked the fucking chair a couple times. I was like, I was supposed to fucking freak out. I just fucking turned around. I just walked out of the fucking joint. And, you know, Gitlin, our amigo, calls me and he goes, you're in first position for that fucking movie. I went, big deal, because I was still in the middle of doing a fucking development deal thing. I was trying to get a fucking TV show on, so I didn't give a fuck about that movie. Go was a fucking brilliant fucking cult classic. I used to work with Doug Liman, the guy who directed that, but it was like, I mean, it came at a really fucking shitty point in my life, but I got the role, and I was like, that's when I started to realize. But yeah, I mean, you know, you don't realize as a comedian, you can still get these things. If you can audition well, you can get them, you know? And so...
Yeah, right, because you got the deal first. I hung with you. I met you when you were in the process of the deal.
Yeah, and trying to find...
You would go to Hoy's Walk. You would always buy me lunch at Hoy's Walk.
That's right.
On Sunset and La Brea. We would smoke a joint. We'd go back to your house. And then you also discovered that I was the real deal when I called the quarterback that
night. Dude, I made my fucking chili. I had the world class chili. You were watching the game, and you were calling the plays. John Elway's going to run this thing in
Monday himself. Night
watch
football. This guy's got balls. How it works.
Oh my God, bro! You called it, he was calling him, and they get, that was the play where he jumps in, he gets hit in the back, and spins around, and Rant landed in.
I go watch. Elway's going to run this in.
Yeah,
I was calling the play because I knew Denver so well.
It was like he was in the huddle.
I was watching Denver for years. I was there when Elway got drafted. I was there when against Cleveland, when he made the drive against Cleveland. Yeah. I knew Elway like the back of my hand.
Yeah.
I knew that he had to get the right team.
Dude, I knew football, and you were like three. I go, this motherfucker.
Oh, I knew that.
Legitimate.
I knew them. By this time, I was watching.
Because you used to collect book over there when you were watching from the booth with them.
So I would watch. The Broncos till the end. I knew Elway's. You know, I still remember when they won their first championship. I cried because I always knew Elway was a winner. When I heard that story about how the Yankees, when fucking the guy went into the meeting, and Steinbrenner opened up the cabinet and left field was Elway.
Yeah,
he goes, I don't care about fucking football. That's my team. In 2 years, I want John Elway because Elway could.
He was a baseball player.
So. If nobody really knows the story, it's very interesting.
Did he get signed to San Diego?
It was a scam.
Oh.
They scammed everybody. First of all, it was the biggest football draft ever for quarterbacks. It was Elway, Marino, Boomer, Esiason. It was like a big fucking draft. And fucking, you got to watch the 30 for 30 because I'm not giving it any justice.
Right.
Elway got drafted by the Baltimore Colts.
That's what it was.
And he didn't want to play for Baltimore. He's like, I'm not going to Baltimore. So Steinbrenner cut a deal with him. Steinbrenner goes, listen, I'll give you $500,000. Give me $250,000 back. You say you play baseball. I send you up there for a couple months. Just play baseball for a few months. We'll forget about this whole thing, and then I'll sell you to Denver. It was like a kinky deal. But Elway, the rumor was Elway could step on the warning track with his left foot and without moving, put it in the catcher's mitt. That was the rumor, that Elway could get a ball and just fucking launch it and put it right in the catcher's mitt. That was how good Elway was, but he couldn't hit. He was phenomenal. His arm was great. He could field. Something
he
really
just couldn't
hit. I don't know the exact story, so that's what they did. It was a scam. Steinbrenner, the king Jew that he was, because Steinbrenner did not take shit from anybody. He got involved. And he got fucking, what's his name? Got him on there. Go take yourself one. He got him on the fucking team. They did something, and then the Broncos picked him up, and that's how the Broncos ended up with John Elway. And John Elway got tortured from day one in Denver. They didn't like him because they were a football town.
Yeah.
And then he started winning, but then he lost four Super Bowls or something, like two Super Bowls or three in a row. They got killed against the Redskins, the only black quarterback to ever go bananas.
Yeah.
Once against him. Fucking Pete, those racists in Denver were going crazy.
Yeah.
Doug.
Oh, that's, he played for Washington.
Yeah.
Ah, jeez, I know who you're talking about.
The guy, he never played football again.
Well, yeah, he never got the credit.
The KKK showed up at his house.
Well, so whatever the deal is. But I mean, Elway did one both.
Doug Williams.
2 years.
Doug Williams was his name. He played for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and they went bananas on the Broncos. That guy never played again. They went to his house the next day and said, you ever play football again? You embarrass white people. You destroyed white people. We will never fucking let you play football again. He's coaching fucking high school football in the Witness Relocation League. You think I'm fucking kidding?
Well, you know what I'd love? I love that Elway, towards the end of his career, wins back-to-back Super Bowls.
Oh, no, he was a bad motherfucker.
But that's what I'm saying. Like,
get that wrong.
No. But I also love that he also got with Peyton Manning and got him to go out. Well, he got surrounded him with enough good players that he got a second ring on his way out. And, I mean, he wasn't Peyton Manning of years before, but all he's doing had to manage the game because that defense was ridiculous. But I love that he got the second Super Bowl ring playing with Doug Elway as the running the front office of that team. The Denver
Sorry Broncos. To go off on the fucking whatever, but it's true. I mean, because of you, I got into an acting class. Because of you, I did what you said. You know, 3 out of 10 comics are going to have a pension.
Yeah.
3 out of 10 comics walk around with no insurance.
Yeah.
You know, three, because they never really thought of the acting side.
No.
I didn't want to be an actor. I didn't start off to be an actor. But I thought it would be a valuable tool in my tool shed.
Yeah.
I knew that some way or another it would help me on stage.
Well, it makes you a better stand-up.
Makes you a better stand-up. When you act, and then comes the day when you incorporate your stand-up into your acting, and now your acting becomes a fucking, like, I don't do a lot of things good. I don't fuck good. I may not be able to cook a fucking steak, but I will tell you what I'm very good at is going into a room with four people in it and fucking them up.
Yeah.
And it's because of the original room. I give that credit to the original room and co-reading workshops.
Yeah.
You combine that together.
And you got something special.
You have something special.
Because, dude, I look at all the roles I've done. I got a lot of fucking roles, and it was just going and straight up auditioning. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a fucking famous uncle. I didn't have a famous dad. I mean, you had to go in with 380 other fucking actors and do the best fucking reading you could. The competition side of that got me fucking excited. I mean, there was about 6 months with me and Billy Gardell. If I didn't get the job, he got the job. If I didn't get the job, he got the job. I got the job. He didn't get the job. But for 6 months, we were going for the same stuff. And then one time, we're just coming around a corner, Warner Brothers, and he comes around the corner and goes, Schubert, how a goddamn. I go, but, you know, that friendly competition makes you better. It gets you know what I mean? I mean, if I didn't get it, I want to know if my friend got it. But like you said, that acting stuff.
I knew when I first got here, I cannot lie to you or to the audience. When I first got here, I had a mental competitive naturally, but to succeed I had to eliminate people as competition and make them my comrades
because you're competing against yourself.
So that's what I do usually. What I did for years was when I get an audition, I made as a cosmic karma thing for me, I would call somebody who was my type and say, did you get a call for this? And they would go, no, I didn't.
You gave me a couple calls
call
like
your
that.
Agent
yeah.
Even though I wanted that role, I would call people just for the karmic energy.
That's great.
To let people know that, because you don't know what they're looking for. I'm the same way. You don't want to give me the job? Don't give it to me, but give it to Lee.
Yeah.
You don't want to give it to Lee? Let's give it to the Agostino.
Yeah.
You don't want to give it to the Agostino? Let's give it to fucking Rogan. You don't want to give it to Rogan? Let's give it to Hinchcliffe.
Yeah.
But you're going to give it to somebody in my family.
Yeah, you got to give it to somebody.
You're going to give it to somebody in my family. Yeah. And that's how I thought when I went into those auditions. Well, I eliminate everybody. I got no competition in this town.
Yeah.
I have no ill will to no comic, anything at all.
I agree with you.
I always feel when Lee gets a special, I just got up.
I feel the
because
same
I hang out with Lee. I just got up. That means I just got up.
My friends' wins are my wins.
Are my wins.
And you have to have that attitude.
And if you don't in this town,
you'll fucking hear.
When I see a hater,
we rot like a piece of fruit from the inside out.
When I see a hater, I giggle because I know they have no future.
Yeah.
They just signaled out their own future themselves.
Yeah.
I told him one day, these open micers you hang out with, you go to lunch with them afterward, I don't want you hanging out with them.
Yeah.
Because they don't know what they're talking about, and they're hating the same way I hated at that level.
Yeah, but
because
you know,
at that level I hated because you don't have what you want. So your frustration. It's hate brought on by frustration.
Yeah.
Now, when I go for an audition, the first guy I call is Nick Turturro. Nick, you going out for this pizza guy? No, I didn't. You know, I would call Vinny Curto. I would call another friend of mine that me and him started together. A mafia role, I'd rather you get it if I don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather one of my friends get it. So
absolutely.
That helps you as a karma level.
Yeah, because you know what? People are worried so much about getting the fucking job, they can't actually go into the room and be who they think they want to be because they're trying to give them something what they think they're looking for. You got to go in and not give a fuck about any of that shit. Only thing you care about what you do in the audition. It does not look, I'm already going in. Look, if I get the job, great. If I don't, fine. I'm fucking attached.
What do I lose?
Yeah,
I'm still going to Minneapolis this weekend.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm doing what I was meant to put on this earth.
That's exactly
right. The acting is a fucking cherry on the sundae.
That's right.
It's a cherry on the sundae.
Yeah.
So I don't give a fuck if I get it or not. It don't matter to me. I started as a dirty comic. That's what I am.
Yeah.
Everything else is background music. I know for a fact, like, and I tell people this, I don't want you to be an actor. Yeah, but I'm a stand-up. I just want you to have the tools.
Yeah.
So if they do call you, you don't look like a fucking Johnny Jerkoff.
Yeah, and they will call.
And they will call. Eventually, somebody's going to call you one day, and you're going to look like Johnny Jerkoff.
Because you didn't do the work.
Because you didn't do the work, and then you're going to blame it on them, and then be, it's like when I first went to the South to do comedy. They don't like you in the Bible Belt. They didn't like me in the Bible Belt. I'll never come back. That's what a loser says.
Right.
A winner says, I'm going to go back there and make them love me.
Yeah.
I got to slow down my act.
It's like Elvis in Vegas, bro.
Right. Let them fall in love with me first. I can't go for the finger bang.
Yeah.
I got to kiss them in the neck and tell them I love them. Tell them I love that song you wrote.
That's right.
I love when you sing barefoot. You know what I'm saying? And then you go for the finger.
Yeah, that's it.
And it's like a fucking finger bang.
No, but it's you know, and I got to tell you, I feel obligated to, like, you know, guys are coming out, they don't get that. I always feel obligated to help because you know how many people did that for me? Like, people fucking took me aside and said, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do this. And all those things. And over the years, this cumulative help that people would give you. And I feel obligated to fucking pass it along to my friends, the people I think that are worthy, that have ability, that have talent, that, you know, like you said, I'm the last guy to get envious or bitter or jealous.
I
don't have it in my heart.
I don't have the time
anymore. Don't have it in my heart, man. I root for fucking everybody. I root more for the guy on stage that he is, you know, because it doesn't make it who it is. There's somebody that, you know, they put the work in. They've been doing it 20 fucking years. I mean, I think only another comedian realized the effort and the tenacity and the fucking grit and the guts it takes to hang in there, even when you think it's all going wrong and still believe in yourself and still do it and still bang it away. And then you fucking look back and sometimes it's ours. You know, I don't stop to sometimes just breathe. I have to look all the way back. Wow, look at all the shit you were able to do. Look at all the stuff. Yeah, sometimes you're going to stop and give yourself credit.
I just saw you in that movie the other night.
What's that?
I've been thinking about you for a month.
Oh, that
because I saw you 3 times in the matter of a couple of weeks. What? I saw you in Old King of Queens.
Right.
I saw you in Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Yeah.
About 2 weeks ago, and I go, I got to call Schubert.
Yeah.
It was 2 a.m. You're the type of guy I could call. I don't give a fuck.
That's right.
You know, I called you. You're an East Coast guy.
Yeah.
If you're sleeping, you're sleeping. Who gives a fuck?
That's right.
I was thinking about you. That's great.
Yeah, I did that American Nightmares on... I was on Cinemax. It's on demand. But Danny,
people have no idea.
Danny Trejo's in it.
When
Vivica Fox.
Go was being filmed, when Go was being cast, how much heat that movie had already from the script.
Yeah.
Like, when that script came out, everybody was trying to go out for the movie Go. Yeah. There's certain movies that come out in this town.
Everybody's
that
trying to get it.
People know. And everybody was getting into Go.
Yeah.
I still remember having a specific conversation with a comic saying that he called the managing office and the manager wanted to sign him and that he gave an ultimatum. I'll sign with you, but you got to get me in for Go. Like, that's how big people knew it was going to be. Scott Wolf, Jay Moore.
Yeah.
And the young girl that's cuter than fuck. She was dating Doug Liman at the time.
Sarah Polley. Katie Holmes.
Katie
Holmes. Bill Fichtner was in it. The girl from Ally McBeal, the blonde girl, was, what's her name? She was on also on 30 Rock. Yeah, it had a fucking amazing cast in it. Tay Diggs was in it. You know, there was a it's a big cast.
The little English guy from fucking
Desmond Eskew was great. I mean, you know, Jimmy Duvall, who also wound up being in the movie I did on Cinemax, where I ran over, what the fuck are you doing here, Jimmy Duvall? But he was in it. Yeah, it was crazy, man. That kind of like really kind of solidified. I didn't realize how big that fucking movie was. It came out and went against The Matrix. It's a cult classic. It made like $19 million over the summer, probably more now worldwide, but it was a great fucking ensemble cast to be part of. Doug Liman, he also put me in fucking Mr. and Mrs. Smith there for... But I mean, you get these little fucking jobs, these little things, and like you said, dude, well, the guy who played my dad, Screaming Freeman, I used to call him, he played the Dane in fucking Miller's Crossing. He was a fucking... guy was the coolest fuck, like this old fucking Marine. And we were in his fucking trailer, and he says, you smoke pot? I go, yeah, I smoke pot. So we smoked a little pot. He started giving me acting lessons. Like, you know, when you're filming over your shoulder, you take your left eye, you put it against my left eye, so open yourself up to camera. Give me like 5 or 6 great little fucking cheats, and I'm fucking high. Are you guys ready for it? Oh, shit. I was... And it was just a pickup shop, and it freaked me out. I ran out. I rented fucking 5 movies just to look at, you know, all of my favorite actors just to study them and shit. And he goes, and ever since then, ever on the movies, that when I went to get high, they called it acting lessons. You want to get some acting lessons after the fucking martini shot? But these guys, but he kind of took me under his arm and kind of told me about these things, and we worked out these scenes. And it was so great to have a guy like that doing your first big movie, and the guy's kind of giving you all these little inside cheats on how to be a better fucking actor and stuff. Because you think as a comedian, you're always kind of playing to the back, you know, but film just registers thought, so you want to keep it tight. And that was a nothing scene I did, but I never did it again for the rest of the movies. Like, I came in there serious and prepared to work, and I said, well, I would only do it after we get done doing our...
It's really weird, the people we've, like, the guy that gave me acting advice the first time ever, and he didn't give me bad advice, like, he just fucking tore into me about it, was James Coburn.
James Coburn.
How fucking weird is that?
How great is that, though? James Coburn, bro. That's old school shit, though. That's cool as fuck.
Like, I didn't say nothing to him. I got there. I shook his hand. Alan Stevens got me the job. You know, James Coburn. I shook his hand. How you doing? Nice to meet you. I didn't say nothing. He goes, you want to run this once or twice? Yeah, let's run it once or twice. We did it. And he goes, look at my fucking hands. Because he had arthritis and shit. And then we just fucking rehearsed the scene, and then we were doing it. And while we were doing it, he said to me that I had natural instincts. Like, this is when they're moving the cameras around you.
Yeah.
And you're standing there like Johnny Jerkoff.
Yeah.
And you're standing 3 feet from the fucking
greatest legend
motherfucker
on the
of all time. And you're trying to keep it together.
Study with Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
Study with Bruce Lee, dude.
He was one of Bruce Lee's mourners. He carried the casket.
I know.
Just,
I,
you don't even want to bring it up. Like, the first day I didn't say nothing. The first day I didn't say nothing. I took his advice. He goes, are you in acting class? I go, yeah. He goes, get the fuck out of it because they're going to ruin your natural instincts.
Wow.
I go, done.
Did you start with Jimmy DiStefano?
At first,
yeah.
Jimmy DiStefano.
Remember Jimmy? I took a couple classes from Jimmy DiStefano.
The first guy I signed with was a guy that was very good. He just hated comedians because he had a bad taste, Dice. This guy was over on Gardner and Sunset. And when he found out I was a comic, he worked me hard.
Right.
And then one night I said to him, what the fuck is your problem? Because he's a New York guy.
Right.
And he goes, I was one of the first guys to ever work with Andrew Dice Clay. He fucked me over on the movie he made.
Oh, Making the Grade or whatever it was?
No, the big one, the Cadillac one, whatever. The one,
oh,
the height of his,
Fort Fairlane.
Yeah, something happened with him and Dice. So he goes, I fucking hate stand-up comics. The class was on Monday nights. So Monday nights was the hottest night in L.A. in those times. You had Latino Night, the Laugh Factory, and the fucking show at the Improv, Freaky Mondays. How am I going to... So I would always have to do my scene and leave. Frank Magna. That was my first acting teacher. I did not book anything with him. I did not get what the fuck he was saying.
Yeah.
Then I did a black guy that had HIV. He was over on Gower in those little huts.
Yeah.
In between Sunset and Hollywood Boulevard.
Right.
Some comic took me there. But I just thought of his face. He's way long gone. He's somewhere married.
Right.
He took me there to a class on Saturday, and I fell in love with the guy. And that guy taught me. That's who I had when I got the call back with Billy Gardell for the Travolta movie.
Right.
The one about the fucking, the singer.
Right.
It was me and Billy Gardell there that morning. I was all coked up.
Oh, wow.
And me and Billy are sitting there, and it's a director from Drugstore Cowboy, and Travolta were in the room. And me and Billy had a read. It was either going to be me or Billy.
Wow.
And then they said, fuck it. We'll make them both stand-up comics. So me and Billy were up for the same fucking role. And next thing you know, Gatlin goes, you got this. Go to Miami. And when I was in Miami, I got a call. Travolta decided to do the Scientology movie instead.
Oh, wow.
So the kiss of Billy Gardell even bit me in the ass at that time, because Billy was kicking ass at that time.
Yeah.
Billy had just booked 4 episodes of that Law show.
He had
his own show on NBC. He got paired up
with he was in the
black dude that wasn't any good. Billy Gardell was booking, but everything he booked was wrong for him. Like, it was just like a stretch of Billy just was having a hard time. He was booking, but then he booked 4 episodes of that
Law and Order.
The show on ABC on Sunday nights, that was huge. That the guy built the studio down in Orange County. You had to go down to Huntington Beach to audition, down the block from Boston Market. They only shot 4 shows down there. He had so many. He was married to Michelle Pfeiffer or somebody.
Oh, David.
Yes, he had so many shows going on at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
That he just told ABC, I'm not leaving Huntington Beach.
Yeah.
Build the studio
they
down
were all,
here.
They were all 4 shoot,
so
shows.
So they would shoot all
there.
4 of his shows down there.
Wow, what was his last name? David Lee, maybe?
David something.
Yeah, but you're right. He was writing Ally McBeal.
Right. He had fucking shows at once, dog. He was rocking it.
Yeah.
And he shot his show out of there, and I'll never forget that. That was the same week that I was going in for Spider. I went all week. I would go down there, and I'd see Billy Gardell and go, God, fucking damn it. But they were looking for 3 different mobsters, 4 different mobsters. So we all had a shot.
Right.
And every time I get to the last callback, fucking Billy Gardell was there.
But it's good, though. It's good competition.
And I'm like, no, but it wasn't a competition. Yeah. I'm like, fuck. The Kiss of Death that's here, because at the time, Billy was the Kiss of Death. Everything he fucking was in would get canceled, or was always a bad role. Billy shot, before Billy got that show on CBS.
Dude, he was in Lucky.
He was in Lucky, he had his own show.
It was the Anthony Clark and the Anthony Clark show. We did like fucking probably like 13 episodes of that show with Anthony Clark and Michael O'Malley. Mike O'Malley, they were on that show before King of Queens on CBS. Yeah, Billy's had a great fucking career acting.
Great
Mike
career.
O'Malley, he's done. He was in the manager in the Jersey Boys. I mean, he's, you know, Billy's worked a lot. Billy gets it, you know.
Great kid too. It didn't happen to a better fucking guy.
Yeah, he's no question great, about.
But
it.
He was struggling for a long time.
Well, everybody is until you get those first couple breaks and stuff. Dude, I was doing La Jolla. Listen to this, bro. I'm doing fucking La Jolla. I get a call Saturday at 5 p.m. Can you do this fucking movie from our boy Rick Bronson, who runs the fucking clubs? He goes, I gotta go shoot me. I got this director. He needs somebody. He's in fucking
Idaho.
Idaho Falls.
Did you shoot that?
Dude, yes. You were supposed to get it.
Yes.
You couldn't do it.
Couldn't do it. I was in West Palm Beach on Sunday. They call you Friday.
How great's this? So he calls me Saturday and says, can you be on a plane on fucking Sunday? I flew up Sunday and they fucking got the hotel, the plane ticket, everything's right. I fucking all day shooting with Hopper Penn, Sean Penn's son, in this fucking movie that's already had 5 or 6 offers on it, called Puppy Fucking Love. The director, Michael Maxis, is a great fucking guy.
Great guy.
All this fucking stuff, and that scene frames the movie. It's in the beginning movie. It's all throughout the movie. It's all these little stories. It's probably going to premiere at South by Southwest, but that was a role that you were supposed to fucking do. They wanted you. He goes,
called me Friday.
He called you, and he called me Saturday. And I go, I'm going to have to thank Joey Diaz for not being able to do it.
I was in West Palm Beach. They called me Friday. They made an offer Friday. I thought about it. I go, so when do you need me? They go, Monday. I had 20 things on Monday.
Yeah. No,
like,
I get it.
I was just about to sell that show to Fox.
Yeah.
Like, I'm right there. Like, I had those meetings with writers. I had something. And I had something that Monday. Because when they first called me, they said, we could shoot it Monday or Tuesday the latest. There was something going on still. And I go, Monday's going to be hard, but Tuesday. So I would have had a flown from West Palm to L.A., shit.
It's 11 pages of dialogue, too. It was a monster where they were, I was like, oh, shit. I mean, that whole night I got there of Saturday, well, I flew in Saturday, Sunday night, and I was just fucking working on those lines, the whole thing. And he was great about it. And he goes, I needed somebody to anchor the scene. So, I mean, I wasn't his first choice, but it didn't make a difference. I got the role. I meant to thank you for that, too, because I go, you know, it's shit, man, you know, the movie's already a kick-ass fucking movie. These scenes were just reshoots for him so he could get the fuck, because he wants to fucking premiere it. And he's been editing it for a year and a half with Sean Penn and fucking Michael Madsen, Roseanne Arquette, fucking Wayne Newton. There's a bunch of fucking cool fucking soundtrack things in it. It's a killer. It's like Forrest Gump, except the other direction, where Forrest Gump has an amazing, spectacular life. This guy's life is filled with freaking, you know, hookers and crack pipes and fucking all this shit in another direction. And Puppy Love is but I'm telling you, the guy is a fucking great movie director. It was great to work with him, Michael Maxis. And I think this movie is going to be a big fucking deal. It reminds me of Go. It's the same kind of vibe as like Go, but this guy. And so.
Yeah, it was a plane to Utah, another flight to Idaho Springs where I got a warrant.
Yeah.
And then I had to drive for an hour.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, I don't know. I got a bad back as it is. Plus the 6 hours from West Palm up. Yeah. That would have been a whole day of flying.
Yeah, I'm dude. I'm too old. You know what, dude? It is.
And I had the thing on Monday, but I'm happy you got it.
Yeah, I'm happy. That's what we're just talking about. I know. That's what I'm saying. It was fucking karma because it was like one of those things because, you know, I came at the right time for me, and I just, you can. What do I got to lose? Yeah, I could do it. They let me out of the show on a Sunday night at the La Jolla, which they never used to do a Sunday night show down there before, but now I guess they're cooking with gas, so they do it's the Friday, Saturday, Sunday show. So they let me out of it, went to fucking Idaho Falls, got the fucking part, worked on it all day, then hung out with fucking Sean Penn's kid, Hopper Penn. We hung out, went out for drinks afterwards, and then jumped on a fucking plane, flew to Philadelphia, where I did the Parks Casino on a Wednesday night. So I literally had that gap Sunday.
How great is the Parks Casino?
It's great. It's great. It's right there in Bedsell. Oh, dude, that's 7 minutes from my mom and dad's house. That Parks Casino. That's a neighborhood I grew up in out there. Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah, dude, I love it.
That was tremendous.
Yeah.
I'm going back next year.
Yeah, it's a great casino.
Like, I'm going back. They all made an offer, and I said, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, I loved it. I loved everything about that.
Yeah.
The drive there, everything was sensational. Because you land, you got to drive. The guy took me to some cheese shake place, and I didn't even know. And
yeah.
You get there.
What was it, Steve? Prince of Steaks up there in front of me?
Yeah.
Dude, you got to take a hot shower. That's one of the best cheesesteaks ever. It's right around the corner from Parks, and it's like this real gooey. But they use the real like cuts, like thin cuts of like prime rib. It's like delicious. It's like one of the best steaks I've ever had. It's Steve Prince of Steaks, which is about 5 minutes from where that joint is, Parks Casino.
Tremendous. I thought Parks Casino, that was where I fucking just got off the stage and went into the audience. They were that crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't even go in the green room.
They're big fans of Joey.
Yeah.
My nephews listen to your
favorite. They're crazy. Yeah, they're crazy. Everybody Philadelphia's fucking crazy. That's why I love it. That's why I belong there. Like, whenever I go there, I go say some crazy shit. I watch Eleanor on stage talking about getting fingered on the Morty's Pier. I almost puked.
You were laughing, Zora.
Yeah, what's Morty's Pier?
Oh, it's down in Wildwood, New Jersey. Everybody goes down the shore. It's like one of those things. It's like, you know, everybody goes down the shore. Everybody went down to Wildwood, New Jersey for the summertime. You come down there, you know, my grandmother would pawn her jewelry so she could get enough money. So we'd go down the fucking shore for 2 weeks as kids, and we would go down there and spend time in, like, you know, Longport or fucking.
So where's Morty's Pier?
Morty's Pier is Wildwood? Down in Wildwood. Yeah, it's like, you know, down Wildwood. And, you know, all those fucking, you know, all those freaking Wow, why would they? That's like part of Philadelphia culture. The Mummers, Scrapple, all that Philadelphia shit, soft pretzels, fucking Wildwoods, every bit of part of that. Go, let's get down to the boardwalk and play the shooty shoots for a quarter. I got us a fucking case of Schaefer, but I'm drinking Schaefer beer. Or like, you know, when you were a kid growing up and the boardwalk and all that shit comes flooding back and she got finger banged underneath Morty's Pier. Fucking Wildwoods.
When she said that, I lost my shit. I don't even know what Morty's Pier was.
How funny is fucking Eleanor Carroll? Dude, she's fucking rocking, dude.
What a success story.
I love it, dude. I love that she, you know, I mean, she's fucking really tremendously fucking talented. But to watch her go from the waitress at the Comedy Store to fucking doing a WWE and the stuff and actually go opening for Dice and how strong she's become as a comedian. Nellie is like a fucking sister to me, man. I fucking love her to death. She's a sweetheart. She's got a heart of gold.
With all her success, you
know? Yeah, me too. I mean, I just love watching somebody like her get so fucking good and so funny. And dude, she's fucking. I had to follow her one time. She was working with me in La Jolla. She just fucking slaughters.
She slaughters.
I mean, dude, I love it. I love it, dude.
Jimmy, can you believe 30 years you're doing this?
I know. It's a fucking...
30
fucking years. 30 years. I mean, make a living like a professional. I mean, it could have gone either way. I could have gone... I would have had doves up my ass and out of my sleeves. I could have gone into magic, but I went into fucking comedy. And like you, I feel this is exactly where I'm supposed to be. I mean, I love making a room full of people fucking laugh, whether it's 1,000 people or 200 people or 14 fucking people. I don't give a shit. I love it. I love being able to create comedy. I love being able to take control of a room and just make people laugh so that they fucking piss themselves. I mean, there's nothing better than that. I mean, you know when people come up to you and go, they grab me by the arm and say, I haven't fucking laughed like that in so long. I fucking needed that. I mean, you know, I don't ever take that for granted. I just, to be able to do that is a fucking gift, and to be able to touch people and move people with your fucking jokes and something you created and write comedy. And you don't know, there's somebody in the audience thinking about killing himself. Maybe they lost their favorite aunt. Maybe something's going on in life and they come in there and sit in front of you for 45 minutes. You get to make them laugh, and before you know it, they forget about all that shit, and they walk out and go, God damn it, that's real power, and it's healing, and it's fucking everything I fucking love. And I just, dude, it just feeds my soul, and I believe I'm exactly what I'm supposed to be doing, making people laugh.
Jimmy Schubert, I feel in my heart you're one of the 10 top comics working today.
Oh, dude, that's fucking awful. Nice of you to say that, bro.
With all the confidence in my heart, I can tell you that, because I know what you've been through. You know, I watch these guys that think this is a fly-by-night business. Nobody pisses me off more than these fly-by-night comics. They get into comedy for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
You know, you're a guy that, this is 30 years. You take every year how it comes.
And I get better and better with
Yeah, that. Yeah. No, imagine doing this for 30 fucking years. You're going to get good at it.
Dude.
Eventually, if you do this same move for 30 years, hammering nails,
dude,
you're going to get really good at it. 30 I feel the same years.
Dude, watching fucking you, and I remember all the fucking old nights at the fucking original room and the fucking, you know, and watching you go up there and fucking annihilate, bro. You are the most authentic fucking voice in front of God. Dude, I watch you do the fucking, just fucking slaughtering. You're fucking hilarious. You're authentic. You are true to who you are, and you're doing. It's the same thing, man. It's like fucking. You watch guys who put the time in and pay the dues, and you just go, man, it's fucking amazing.
You know what you're talking about? Getting booed, but I got booed at a Buffalo hockey game.
Of all the fucking places to get booed at hockey,
you know, it's those things that you remember forever.
Yeah.
Like, Mad TV was a great experience for me.
Yeah.
Do I wear it like a badge of honor? No, I did two episodes.
Right.
But I tell you what, I wear that bombing in Buffalo like a badge of honor because it made me who I am today.
Yeah.
Those bombings, those beatings, they either take you out of the game.
Dude.
Or you come back with a roast beef sandwich with horseradish and suck my dick and call me shorty.
They'll get booed by 10,000 people. By 10,000 people in front of my fucking mom and dad in my hometown. It was like fucking lifting the kettle off the fucking Shaolin temple, and now you can leave because there's nothing you're ever going to do to me in a fucking comedy room or a comedy place or anything that fucking, that was as bad as fucking that, getting booed in your fucking hometown in front of your friends. Like, yeah, you can't do anything to me in a fucking comedy club that's going to hurt me like that. You can't, I'm not fucking, nothing. I got fucking six brothers. My old man was a homicide detective. I got one feeling, and I fucking dare you to hurt it. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like, you know what I mean? When you go through, you wear those things with a badge of honor. It's like, you can't do anything to me. It's like, you know, but it's great. You got to get those, it's like you said, all those worst nights, and they're the things that build up your, you know what I mean? Like you said, you those were the best. I mean, all the wins are great too, but still, you know.
Those bombings are great. The special you come out, you shot at Flappers. Yeah. When did you shoot it, about last year?
Yeah, I shot it about a year and a half ago, and, you know, we had to, like, do all the posts for it, do the color correction. I financed the whole thing myself. I did the whole fucking thing, top to bottom myself. I got the guys to shoot it. We went in there, we hung curtains, hung lights. I just wanted to go in there, and we shot it in 4K. It's called Zero Tolerance, and it's a fucking straight-up fucking hour of fucking stand-up comedy. We could come up with a cool little opening for it.
I really like the opening.
Yeah, because the opening, you know, the opening is just a fucking, like, you know, it's like in this day and age, like, the things people get fucking upset about now, it's like you're overreacting to all this shit. That's why that kind of, like, diffuses the bomb, you know. It was being censored by social media and oversensitized. It was being expurgated by the political correctness police. It was like that opening is just like, yeah, fuck it, it's comedy, man. I mean, Jesus, dude, I was watching Rodney Dangerfield on like an old YouTube thing. I went down a Rodney Dangerfield rabbit hole, and I go, man, if this motherfucker was alive today, he's fat shaming people. I mean, you couldn't even fucking be Rodney Dangerfield today. I mean, dude, I fucking. It's just funny, like some of the stuff you see, like, do you think Kinison could get away with the stuff he was doing back then? I mean, it still holds up, but I mean, just with the climate and how sensitive people have become, it's fucking ridiculous.
I'm 56 years old, February 19th.
Right.
If you think I give a fuck about your feelings anymore,
yeah,
you got another thing coming. I'm going to talk to you what's in my heart.
Yeah.
You know? It's so fucking weird that I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I don't.
And I ain't apologizing for fucking anything you do. It's like, fuck you. It's like, you know.
The thing that we love the most is going to kill us. And that's social media. You know, I use social media for something completely different.
Yeah.
I don't involve my political thoughts. I don't involve my views or my opinions. I involve what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And I want you to think what I'm thinking today. If you want to make it through today,
yeah,
you better fucking go drink some cough medicine, take a Vicodin, grab your fucking ball, salute the flag,
yeah,
and go be a fucking American and go hustle.
Yeah.
But if you're going to sit there on your ass and bitch, I don't want you around me.
Yeah.
I really don't. There's a formula, and it works.
Dude, I'm fucking with
it
you.
It works, bitch. Yeah. It yeah. works. It's yeah. called washing your pussy and getting out of the fucking house. And doing what you fucking love until you figure out how to make a buck doing it.
Yeah.
And if you don't want to do that, then lay on that couch and you could cry to anybody the fuck else. That's what I put on there in the mornings. I tell you my dates and I get the fuck out of there. I don't need to take a picture of a celebrity. I don't need to show you my fucking diet. Yeah. I show you what I'm smoking.
Yeah.
Because I want you to know what the recipe is. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah,
I'll show
man.
You what I'm smoking.
Fucking Joey Diaz, leg
but
coach.
Now,
like, yeah.
Now you get these people that go to a comedy show. Listen. Social media has just become, you know, when I go on social media on a Saturday just to look at the climate,
yeah,
and I see those same people tweet, and I feel bad for them.
Yeah.
I feel bad for those people that tweet and post on Friday. I want you to get off social media from Friday to Sunday.
Yeah, go enjoy your life.
Go live your life.
Go live your life. Go have some experience.
Life.
Yeah.
Leon on New Year's, I told him right out. I go, if I was 30 years old, I'd give this pinky up right now to the Japanese. For New Year's,
yeah,
I give this pinky up if I go on New Year's Eve to a bar, be comfortable, do two bumps, and have three beers and maybe take a Xanax and go home. I would have done that. I told him, Elite, do something. You cannot stay home. And he went and he made a call and some chick came over, some little victim.
Nice.
And licked his balls and the rest is history. You know what I'm saying? Whether he liked it or not. But you have to live your life.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know.
You cannot be stuck all day.
Well, people do this, they fucking hashtag, they act like they're brave. He was so brave to hashtag it. I go, fucking go out and fucking, you know what I did on Christmas, dude? And it's the first time I've done this. I went down to the Laugh Factory and I fed those fucking homeless people all fucking afternoon. Because I didn't have nothing to do. I wasn't going to go home to my fish. You know, I have kids. I'm going through a fucking breakup. I'm going to fuck it. I'm going to go fucking. I went down there and.
Are you in the Philly chicken done?
Yeah, I mean, we're done.
Jesus.
But anyway, we're out there, you know, just feeding the homeless people and just, you know. I mean, I felt so fucking good doing that.
What did you get out of it?
I just thought I fucking.
I'm not questioning
you
in a bad way.
As I felt about my life, I felt how fucking blessed I was. I went home and I fucking thanked God for all my fucking blessings. I got on stage. I told some jokes. We filled their bellies and then we filled their souls with entertainment. And I got to tell you, Jamie Masada, that guy, he does it on Thanksgiving. He does it on Christmas. It's tremendous, tremendous fucking act of kindness. It was. I felt fucking great just to be a part of it, just to get out of the house. And fucking Tiffany Haddish was there feeding people. And you know, these people don't have to do it. There's fucking Tom Dreesen and everybody's down there feeding people, making sure they had enough to eat. And then they went up on stage and gave them a show. And I thought, well, when they treat these people like fucking human beings, I go, this is fucking fantastic. I mean, if Christmas ain't in your heart, you ain't going to find it underneath the fucking Christmas tree. So it was a really cool thing to do. I'll do it every year now on Thanksgiving, Christmas. I thought it was tremendous. And so, but yeah, but you get outside your own fucking shit, you know, and that's social media derives everybody. They all think they're all caught up in their own bullshit. I mean, go down to the hospital and fucking read the fucking sick kids who ain't never getting the fuck out of that hospital, or go feed some fucking homeless people, or go to the old, I mean, go do some real shit. I always say that. Get outside of your fucking self. If you're depressed, you get outside yourself. You see how fucking lucky you got it, you know? And, you know, but it's just, I'll be doing that again, too, on Thanksgiving.
It's crazy what happened to me.
Dude, he ran over 1,000 people through there. 1,000 people, fucking hungry people, just fucking having had a good meal. Not a good meal, but just fucking, you know, we treat them like human beings in there. They were, hey, Merry Christmas, give them a plate of food. Here, you watch a show. It was just phenomenal. The kids coming in with toys. They had toys they could unwrap. It was fucking amazing. And he doesn't have to do that. He's been doing it for 39 years. It just kind of fucking moved me, man. You know, I just thought it was something special. And I was
glad. It's crazy. I had a couple of bums.
What's that?
A couple of 20s on Christmas Day. It was funny because Lee and I, and Eric Rocha, went up to Oxnard last weekend.
Oh yeah.
We would always have to stop at the 101 by Tahunga and Magnolia, right. Riverside. There's homeless people living under there. And me and I would beep the horn, and they just weren't in there.
Right.
Oh, their shit was there, but they weren't there. I'm like, Lee, open the window. I would open Lee's window and go, hey, and Lee would go, lock the window. We're going to get killed here, whatever. And you make the right-hand turn and you hit the 101.
Right.
Christmas Day, I got up and I was sitting there and I'm like, what the fuck is going on in my life? I got to take a ride anyway. And I got in the car and at that light, I finally saw the three homeless dudes. It's a black chick with a backpack. And two white dudes, and they were dressing up like teddy bears. They were trying to hustle teddy bears. So I just beeped the horn and gave them each a fucking 20 on Christmas Day. And the black chick looked at me like, take your dick out.
Yeah.
Like, I'll suck it for 20. I've been hustling for quarters, and you just came. They had a Starbucks. They were happy. That's it.
Yeah, I mean,
that's,
you know,
the best I could fucking do on Christmas. You know, I mean,
you know, bro,
you gotta do something. You gotta help somebody on Christmas.
I think so. It's that time of year, you know. I think you know, and you just sometimes people, like, if you reflect on your life and you look back, you go, God, I'm incredibly fucking blessed.
Oh my God.
I mean, you know, am I where I want to be? No. Am I gonna keep working to where I want to be?
Yeah. Everybody wants to fucking be
somewhere else, but sometimes be thankful for where you are. You're still alive, like my old man says. You know, get up every morning, goes, I'm a fucking happy. Just be awake on the fucking right side of the grass. You know, my old man's 85. You know, I'm lucky enough to still have him, so I don't take any of that for granted either. I mean, you know, you just get to do something you love to do. You still got I got a great family. I mean, you know, freaking knock wood, man. God bless, you know.
When's the special come out, Schubert?
The special is going to be dropping on January 15th. If people go to jimmyschubert.com, and it's S-H-U-B-E-R-T, like the theater, jimmyschubert.com. It's going to be on Vimeo on demand, but you can just go to my website. It'll take you on the Vimeo on demand, and plus it'll be on Vimeo. But I'll be tweeting about it if people want to check out my social media. Everything's at Jimmy Schubert at Twitter and Instagram and everything else. There'll be a big announcements coming. So if they follow me on social media or they want to check back, January 15th, which is a Tuesday, I'll be dropping my brand new hour special on Vimeo on demand. So they can rent it, they can buy it, they can do whatever they want with it. But I'm really excited about this hour. I worked my ass off on it. And so it's finally coming out, and I'm just going right to the people.
Like, I tell people all the time, you, Tom Rhodes, all you guys, you guys are the backbones of comedy. I watch you guys, and I always learn something. Like, and we're on the flip side of the coin, but the coin flips at any time.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? So I wish you all the luck in the world, and I thank you very much for helping me out when I got here.
Dude, my pleasure.
It meant the world to me, and now I can do the same for Lee and other guys.
I understand that.
You have to pass it along. Part of this is not about talent.
Yeah.
It's about passing out love to somebody. You gotta help people having a hard time. Yeah.
Fucking Bobby Lee tells a story. He was with the back edge at the Comedy Store. He said he had it eaten in 3 fucking days. I go, well, what the fuck are you waiting for? Come on. I fucking took him down to Carney's. I fucking shoved the hot dog down his throat. I said, get something to fucking go do, you fuck. I've been that guy. I had to sleep on the fucking roof of the Comedy Store. I had to fucking sleep in my car. I had to crash at Crestal. I wasn't allowed up there. He was trying to fucking hustle and make a living and hang out till things got better. I totally get it, man. It was my pleasure. And that's my fucking pleasure to see you have this fucking huge success that you're having now. I fucking love you, Joey Diaz. Happy New Year. And thank you for having me on, man.
Thank you. Good luck to you, too. Don't forget, January 12th, I'm at the fucking Ice House just working out. All the notes I've been doing the last 2 weeks are all coming out on the 12th. Come on by and say hello. Then at the end of the month, the 20-something, I don't know what fucking date it is, the 24th, I'm in Bray Improv the whole weekend. It's the last weekend of January. Come on out and say hello. I want to thank Jimmy Schubert for fucking rocking it. And if Netflix ever does the 5 good guys of comedy, I hope you're on it because you're a really fucking good guy.
Well, thank you, brother.
I want to thank number one on it. Listen, it's January fucking 3rd. You wanted to change your life. It all starts from within, writing goals, walking, whatever little things you want to do. But at the same time, you could fucking go over to onit.com and get the party started with either some Alpha Brain or some Shroom Tech. Their fucking golden seal is the Alpha Brain. You want to focus, a little bit more fucking energy, Alpha Brain is the way to go. Listen, it's their fucking bread and butter. If you don't like it, they'll give you a refund and your money back without the fucking product. Only Onit stands behind their fucking flagship product like that. So do me a favor. If they have that much belief, how much belief should you have? Go to Onit.com right now and press in.
Church.
And get 10% off your order. I can only help you with supplements. I cannot help you with kettlebells or fucking bats or anything like that. But you know what? Get them too. Who gives a shit? Number two, you want to start the year off healthy? You want to start the year off smelling clean? And nothing says I love you like a clean fucking asshole. You understand me? I bend you over. I open up those cheeks. I smell fumes of death. What do you expect? Nobody's going to lick your asshole. Everybody wants to lick your asshole, but nobody wants to wash it. That's why you got to go to HelloTushy.com because they got portable bidets that you install in 7 minutes. And now from the end of fucking time, let me tell you something. When you die, the coroner's going to look at your asshole and go, let me tell you something. This guy's asshole was in good shape. Why? Because you got HelloTushy.com. Go to HelloTushy.com right now and press in.
Muffler.
Muffler. And keep your muffler clean. They got a 60-day money-back guarantee, but you're not going to need it. Because if it's held my fat, stinky ass for 3 years, think what it could do for your fucking regular fucking ass. Lee, have you broken your Hello Tushy?
And no, it's still there.
And if it could pump that hummus fly swatting off his neck ass, it'll take anything. You understand me? I can't even imagine what Lee's shit
smells
like.
They're going to put that on the box. Handle
fucking
Lee's hummus.
The fucking hose taps out and shit. Now, everything's intact. Go to HelloTushy.com and press in.
Muffler.
And get a portable bidet installed in your fucking house by you, 7 minutes. Because remember, health starts in your asshole. All right? And then you slip back a little bit and you wash the bat side of your nutsack so you don't develop any algae or barnacles. I found the barnacle in my nutsack about 4 years ago. Ever since I've been with Hello Tushy, no more fucking barnacles. I had to go to a fucking ship welder's yard to weld the barnacle off my nutsack. Go to HelloTushy.com and press in.
Muffler.
Bam! And get that asshole fresh by Valentine's Day. You understand me? I want to thank Jimmy Two Shoes Schubert. Go to JimmySchubert.com for a special. I want to thank the Christ Killer. I want to thank you guys for being loyal soldiers and for always loving me as much as I love you. Kick this fucking mule, Lee. See you guys Monday morning, ready to rock the 7th of January when this shit really gets cooking. Do your thing, Lee.
I want to be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart. Somebody twice as smart as I. A somebody who will swear to be true as you used to do with me. Who'll leave you to learn that misery loves company? Wait and see. I mean, I wanna be around to see how he does it when he breaks your heart to bits. Let's see if the puzzle fits so fine. And that's when I'll discover that revenge is sweet, as I sit there applauding from a front row seat. When somebody breaks your heart like you,